Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 53, Safe Booking. Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you have joined us for This Week in Law, Episode 53. We're here today with three wonderful legal experts and myself, and I'd like to introduce you to them all. We've got Jonathan Bailey from Plagiarism Today. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Pleased to meet you.
Thanks for having me. It's been about a year, actually, almost a year to the day.
Yes, far too long.
Last time it was right after Mardi Gras, and it's right after Mardi Gras now. You see? There you go.
Perfect. Well, it's a tradition, but hopefully it won't be quite such a delay next time around.
I hope so. That'd be nice. Okay.
All right. Also back with us, another return visitor, Justin Gray from Gray on Claims. Hi, Justin.
Hello, everybody. Good to be back for another show.
Great to see you. And a regular visitor to our show, Evan Brown. Evan from Internet Cases, thanks so much for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you too. Just when I thought we weren't going to have any Facebook stories for this week, Facebook came along and I guess infected a whole town somewhere in Great Britain with syphilis. So, I just wanted to make
that
sure
happens.
You guys were all safe, and of course I'm kidding and intend no libel, slander, or anything other than ridicule of the whole flurry of Facebook has given a town syphilis stories, which seemed to break in the last day or so.
They apparently went around and just injected everyone. It was horrible. It was the Facebook executives themselves, in fact. It was a horrible conspiracy. It had the black vans and everything. It was terrible.
Terrible. Well, Facebook obviously is quite distressed about those kinds of implications, or that any sort of Facebook activity could be linked with an increase in syphilis, and have been busy doing damage control on this. And there's a nice post at TechCrunch about it that we have in our show notes that says that everyone should calm down. Facebook is not giving people syphilis, but it is kind of a funny... It's both a funny example of what can happen in a media frenzy, and also, I mean, the underlying story, although it is based on what we learn in law school, is a piece of faulty logic known in Latin as post hoc propter hoc, if I'm saying that right. After the fact, therefore, because of the fact, which doesn't really stand up to any kind of hard thinking, and that can go ahead and be our tip of the week. Yeah. Post hoc ergo propter hoc doesn't quite work for it, but I thought it was funny on a couple of fronts, and so just wanted to make sure everyone was doing okay with their Facebook usage and has been getting their annual checkups and is in good health. Evan, you all good on your end?
Yeah, I think so. I've been practicing safe Facebook usage. So, yeah, everything's okay from here. But, yeah, this was really interesting how, you know, small data set, you know, small sampling here, you know, just looking at some conclusions in this one town. You know, so there's some bad science going on here. And then obviously some reporting gone wild here and conclusions running with those conclusions. So this was a really funny story. I'm glad you mentioned it in the links for today.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone in the chat room is asking about suing for libel over that kind of thing, which of course is the, you know, it's not something I would expect to see Facebook do here. They're used to having people make sort of outrageous claims about them in the media, but it's something that certainly could come up. Defamation law involves when you're going around saying things that are untrue about somebody else, but if you're simply expressing an opinion or talking about a correlation, as is the case here, then there probably could be no liability. But you know, as far as safe booking goes, as Man in Hat in the chat room says, I don't know if coining something like that would be exactly actionable. Jonathan, any thoughts about what Facebook might do about this other than attempt to put out fires?
I think this is more of a PR issue for Facebook. I really don't see how this would be actionable on a libel front at all. It's like I said, they're just pointing out correlation. And it's one of those stories that sounds like it kind of got run through the telephone game a little bit. Someone noticed that, you know, that a few people in this subset had you know, sexual relationships through Facebook and other social networking sites, and that's how they obtained syphilis. Therefore, Facebook is going around giving people syphilis. It's a story that just got passed around. I don't think there would, A, be any one party that'd be particularly vulnerable to a libel claim, but also just, I think Facebook's more interested in the PR aspect of this, trying to put out fires, as you said.
Yeah. Jonathan, I wanted to follow up with you about something we discussed last week, and that is the Google versus Viacom litigation and the summary judgment filings that were recently made public. You did a lengthy piece on that, and I don't want to go too deep on it, but just wondered if you had any sort of quick takeaways for us, any highlights that might be the most interesting or salient parts of what happened with the summary judgment briefing.
This summary judgment becoming public, this was a banner day for copyright news in this year. People like me that report on copyright news and try to make jokes about it. This was, you know, this was a great day. If I were a late night talk show host, this would be the type of thing I'd run with for a very long time. But basically speaking, a lot of the information that had been kept secret during the course of the lawsuit was revealed in the course of these statements of fact that were filed along with the motions for summary judgment, the Viacom and Google case. And the result is we have all kinds of interesting, juicy tidbits, and it's sort of a little bit of mudslinging, I would argue, along the way, as Google and Viacom exchange some heavy blows. Viacom accusing YouTube, especially during the dark days before they were purchased by Google, of uploading infringing clips themselves, being aware of infringing clips and not taking any action. Just a variety of, I guess you would say, both direct and tacit infringement, tacit approval of infringement on YouTube. And they have some pretty humorous email chains to point that out. Meanwhile, YouTube and Google are pointing out Viacom, A, can't even be sure which clips are infringing. They had to retract several hundred clips from the case because it was found later that they themselves had uploaded them, so they were not infringing. And also that they had to retract many of their takedown notices as well. And it was also came out in this that Viacom had done several somewhat sneaky things, like attempted to upload, like sent employees down to Kinko's to upload clips to YouTube so that way the IP addresses couldn't be traced back to Viacom. And it also, and they also apparently attempted to buy Viacom, and at one point even indicated they were willing to share ownership of Viacom attempted to buy YouTube, rather, and they attempted to share ownership of YouTube with Google. And so they're trying to position Viacom as kind of the jilted lover in this. Just a lot of really good mudslinging and a very interesting behind-the-scenes look at how both companies have approached video sharing.
You know, from a procedural standpoint, when the summary judgment hearings are and how close we are to getting some kind of judicial response to all this?
We're due for the responses, I believe, in early April, I'm wanting to say. So the deadline for that is coming up pretty fast. The actual summary judgments were filed, I think, March 5th, and they were just released to the public about a week ago. I think we're due for the responses. I think we're expecting some kind of judicial responses sometime around June, late May or June is what I've been hearing.
Great. Thanks for that. One thing that Viacom would certainly love to have going for it in this litigation is some degree of criminal liability that it could argue applied, or that it could, implore the attorneys general of the states and the United States to bring to bear. We do not have criminal liability for inducing or allegedly inducing copyright infringement in this country. But there is a fascinating piece, you know, among the many, many leaks and speculations about ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Something that has come out recently is a provision in the proposed international treaty that no one really knows what's in there, but this is the latest leak, has criminal liability for copyright and trademark infringement. And there's a wonderful commentary on this by Andrew Moshernia over at the Citizen Media Law Project, where he says he feels like he's taking crazy pills because this is the latest bit of intelligence about ACTA. Andrew's piece really speaks for itself, and it's quite eloquent, but he ends by saying that he really kind of hopes that they are trying to inject this criminal liability provision because he thinks that there's no way the U.S. Congress or the EU Parliament would ever be able to really swallow that. Evan, what do you think? Is this a way of kind of overturning everything, the way that we do everything in the United States, if this gets enacted? What are your thoughts?
First of all, I think that I agree with you that Andrew's piece is very well written. It's eloquent, but I just really don't buy what he's saying that it's going to outlaw the internet. You know, get over yourself, Andrew. It's a great overstatement. It's what he even quotes from the language there and says that, you know, the provisions of this section, you know, referring back to the criminal liability, you know, the provisions providing for criminal liability, that those would apply to inciting, aiding, and abetting the offenses. I don't know if that's the same thing as what inducement is or not. I would think that there might be a slightly higher standard to apply in a criminal context as to what kind of substantial steps have been taken to help somebody commit this crime, so to speak. So I just, for some reason, I just don't put a whole lot of emphasis on this. I don't take it very seriously. You know, at the same time, I don't know that something like this would stop U.S. legislators or EU legislators from going ahead and adopting it, especially if there's a strong lobby from the entertainment industry to support it. So, again, just to summarize, I think it's well written. It's kind of clever the way he's put it together. It's a very well written blog post, but vastly overstates it, and in my mind, does disservice to the point he's trying to make on it here.
Yeah.
So you're saying your thought is that inciting, aiding, and abetting is something quantitatively more than, say, inducement.
Probably. And I'm not even sure that, well, I say that because who on earth knows what these are supposed to mean? Who on earth knows what an inducement is? I don't even know that we can say that it's not the law of the land, that there would be no criminal provisions in the U.S. law for inducement liability. You know, we've got to remember there's nothing in the Copyright Act that actually spells out the rules and the contours of secondary liability for copyright infringement. That's something that the courts have looked at. And so, you know, there are certainly some provisions of the Copyright Act that provide for criminal liability in a rare set of circumstances. And I don't know that it would get tossed out that easily if there were to be a criminal prosecution for secondary liability the way it is right now. But I'm just kind of throwing that out, kind of thinking out loud. Haven't researched it. But it just kind of underscores the point I'm trying to make on this is that saying that the internet is going to be broken because of this is just a gross overstatement.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, the whole ACTA controversy has been very prone to overstatement. I mean, that's kind of been the theme of the entire ACTA controversy. It seems like every time someone mentions ACTA in any regard, it's outlawing the internet. Sites like YouTube won't be able to exist. It's this complete and utter panic. And then when actual information does come out, it usually turns out to be much more muted. Like I remember one leak recently found that most of what was in ACTA was very similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act here in the United States. Well, that certainly might impact strongly countries like Canada that don't have a lot of the elements of the DMCA that we have. To Americans, obviously, it would not have a drastic impact. It wouldn't be a drastic change. And so, my honest opinion, there's sort of a panic over ACTA and everything that comes out about every leak. And that's one of the problems. We don't know if these leaks are authentic or not. We're still waiting on any kind of an official draft. But there's this deal to take it to the absolute, complete extreme possible where the sky is falling and we're all going to die, basically. And I think it's doing the entire debate a huge disservice.
It's much more interesting reading, you know, when blog posts are written
like that. You're getting a lot more hits to your blog with that headline. I'll agree with that.
Maybe it'll start giving people syphilis soon.
No. I tell you what, if you make a post where ACTA gives people syphilis, you'll be on dig in no time. I guarantee it.
Guaranteed. Well, I mean, part of the problem in all seriousness and the reason for the panic and hyperbole that does seem to be out there in the world is the secrecy around the negotiations. And certainly if some of that were to go away and there were more transparency, it would be good all around. There's a great discussion about all this over on Floss Weekly for folks who may not have checked out our sister show here on the TWiT network with Simon Phipps, who I once had a delightful lunch next to at some conference or other. And Simon had some great thoughts and comments about ACTA as well. He is no fan of the pending whatever it may be, and certainly no fan of the secrecy. And he pointed out, and I'm going to point out too, that EFF has some great automated forms for emailing your senators to let them know that we would like to shine some light on what's going on here so that people can actually see what's being proposed. Virgil in the chat room was wondering about the what would Trump, in a case of something like this being enacted, an international treaty or the law of the land in the United States. And that's always an interesting tension. Here in the piece we were discussing from the Citizen Media Law Project, there is some discussion of that too. And basically, the end result is that since our executive branch has agreed to participate in these negotiations and has agreed to going along with ACTA in principle, at minimum, it would place a lot of pressure on our judicial system and legal enforcement system to go ahead and follow along, even if it hasn't, if it changes the way that we do things now in the United States. So,
There was the recent ruling, though, involving the Berne Convention, finding that it was not self-executing in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and that statutory damages were not eligible to foreign plaintiffs in copyright cases unless they had the copyright registration. So there would be that element of it. There'd be a question whether or not the treaty is self-executing or not. But once you get into international treaty negotiations, you pretty much left me behind. So I'll leave it there. That's the one smart thing I can say on it.
All right. Justin, are you back with us?
I hope so.
There you are.
Can you guys hear me?
I can see you. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Sorry for the technical difficulties there. Justin, you want to tell us what's going on? Justin is a patent lawyer, and there are a couple of or a few things that I wanted to explore with him specifically. Number one is this notion of false marking, which is, it's fairly rigorous to go through the patent system and actually obtain a patent. Much easier to just stick an indication on your product that it is in fact patented when that's not actually the case. But of course, that's not legal. And the Federal Circuit has recently come out with some clarity on how people are going to be penalized for that kind of act. Can you explain that a bit for us?
Sure, sure. Just to give a little bit of background on this, for those companies who have patents, this only really affects companies who have their own patents. We don't see, or at least I haven't seen as much of the situation that you just described of a company that doesn't have any patents and is just placing a mark on their product that it's covered by U.S. patent 123456. So there is a marking statute in the patent laws that gives incentive to those companies who have patents and make products that are covered by those patents to mark their products with patent numbers. This incentive is given for various reasons, one of which is to notify the public at that, when they see a product, it has a patent number on it, that at least the holder of that patent thinks that the product is covered by the patent, so the product is covered by some sort of intellectual property and shouldn't be covered. Another reason for for marking products with patent numbers is to try to cut down on the amount of litigation, amount of patent litigation, so that everybody knows what everybody else has. The benefits of patent marking is that you can get damages, potentially get damages that are arising before you file a lawsuit against somebody who you believe infringes your patent. If you have a patent and you don't, and you make products that are covered by that patent, but you choose not to mark those products with a patent number, your damages are limited to the time when you gave the infringer of the patent actual notice, sending them a letter, or as it happens in most cases, filing a lawsuit. That's when the damages clock starts ticking. So there is a benefit to marking products with patents. You can get a lot more past damages. But what goes kind of hand in hand with that is the thought that we don't want folks marking products with patents that don't cover those products. And so we have the false marking statute. It's 35 U.S.C. 292. And it imposes penalties associated with falsely marking patents on products with an intent to deceive the public. The penalties associated with this have been kind of in flux before the Federal Circuit's big decision late last year. The statute itself states that the penalty associated with this false marking is no more than $500 for every such offense. The courts in the past have interpreted this every such offense language in different ways, some saying that it's just one $500 fine regardless of how many products you falsely marked. So it doesn't matter if I marked one product or a million products. If I'm found to have falsely marked with an intent to deceive the public, I get a $500 fine. Other courts have used a time-based approach to false marking, so a penalty for every day or every week or every month that the false marking is going on. And other courts had used a per-article approach.
Can I back you up for a second here, Justin?
Yes. Yes.
Why would somebody put the wrong, they have various patents, one of which may cover the object in question. Why would they put the wrong patent on there? What is to be gained from that?
There's an argument that, if I have 10 patents or 20 patents listed on a product versus one, folks may in the public may think, oh, there's a lot of intellectual property covering this product versus just one patent, then, I may think, oh, well, maybe there's one patent. I don't know exactly what it is without looking at it. But the product might be much more protected.
That there was more R&D that went into it than what really had as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think potentially, yes. I think that's a potential argument. Other times, it's pretty common, especially with more complicated products. The more complicated the product gets, usually the more patent numbers that could be associated with that product. A common practice, at least up until now, is to mark a product like that as being covered by one or more of the following U.S. patents. And you use that language on a sticker that's on your product, and then you list a whole bunch of different patents. And that can be done also for just efficiency's sake, especially for large companies that have a lot of patents, have a large patent portfolio, and also sell a lot of products. It can be quite time-consuming and expensive to go through a formal analysis of every single one of your, huge list of products and every single one of your huge list of patents and determine whether each patent actually falls, within each product or not. So the Federal Circuit on December 28th of 2009, upon this question being raised of what is the proper penalty, how should we measure penalties associated with false marking, the court determined that the proper penalty is per article, not per decision to mark, not just one $500 fine, but per article. So for each article that is falsely marked, there is some penalty associated with this. And actually backing up for just a second, the reason why we're now seeing a flood of false marking litigation is that the false marking statute is what's called a qui tam action. So essentially anyone, any person or company can sue on behalf of the government for the penalty. And the statute states that in the event that penalty, that the court assesses penalties, the qui tam plaintiff gets half the penalty, and then the other half of the penalty goes to the United States.
I'm so glad we could incorporate more Latin into the show. Yeah.
I do what I can. you know, before December 28th of 2009, there had been a small number of cases where false marking had been alleged. But if the potential penalty is only $500, regardless of how many articles are falsely marked, it doesn't provide as too much of an incentive for a qui tam plaintiff to go into court, potentially spend thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars litigating a case to only split $500 in the end with the government.
Right. So now the penalties, if you're out there mass marketing something that is falsely marked, even though $500 is a low penalty, if you've got enough items, it begins to add up.
Yeah. Right. And one of the cases that is it's currently pending before the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit right now is a false marking case involving Solo Cup Company. That case is particularly interesting because of the number of products that are at issue.
Do they mark every cup?
They marked it's cup lids that are at issue. And they marked 21 billion with a B cup lids with a patent that had expired. So you multiply 21 billion cup lids by $500 and you get $10 trillion. Now, the Federal Circuit in its decision last year, of course, stated that $500 is the maximum penalty. And even a fraction of a penny could be appropriate in the case of expensively priced mass marketed articles, probably like these cup lids.
Hey.
But still, when you're talking about 21 billion articles, even a fraction of a penny, the damages are quite huge.
Yeah. Right.
I just found a way to pay for healthcare reform.
What? What right. if they were healthcare reform?
I just found a great way to pay for healthcare reform, guys. Oh. It's just like a way.
Yep. Well, I don't think the government can actually be a plaintiff in these cases. But Justin, a couple of follow-up questions. First, in the case you just mentioned about the cup lids and an expired patent, it seems like it's pretty clear that, whoops, we should not have an expired patent on our product. But couldn't there be a gray area as to whether the patent actually applies or not? Isn't that sort of subject to interpretation? And who does that interpretation?
Yes, that is subject to interpretation. With the Solo Cup lid case, it's interesting. The case is interesting on, of course, a number of different levels. But the Solo Cup had admitted that it knew the patent had expired. But the reason that it kept marking its cup lids was because of an advice that they had received advice of counsel. And they also did it for just commercial reasons. It would have been, I think they argued that it would have been prohibitively expensive for them once this patent had expired to change every single die that was used to, you know, stamp out these cup lids. So working with their counsel and working with their business folks, they developed a plan that as they would change out these dies that would make the cup lids in the normal course of business, they would make sure that any patents that had expired were taken off of the cup lids. And so, at least at the district court level, the judge granted summary judgment in favor of Solo Cup on the no intent to deceive part of the false marking claim. And so there weren't any damages
that Solo Cup had to pay. Of course, the plaintiff in the case appealed it to the Federal Circuit, and now the Federal Circuit is having to deal with these issues. It's interesting that you bring up expired patents, because after this decision by the Federal Circuit in December of last year, there has been a flood of false marking litigations filed by these Quitom plaintiffs. In the last 3 months, there have been over 115 different lawsuits filed against over 150 different companies alleging false marking. Most of these cases deal with expired patent numbers. They're kind of the low-hanging fruit for the potential types of false marking. So there's definitely just been a flood of litigation on this. There's no indication that this flood is going to stop anytime soon. However, there is some pending patent reform legislation that was recently announced that would limit the types of plaintiffs who can file these suits, limit it from potentially anyone to competitors of the company that they're trying to sue. So if that legislation gets passed, it would also be retroactive. And a lot of these plaintiffs who are seeing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow would then lack standing, and their cases would likely be dismissed. Mm. But it's something that a lot of companies are having to think about a lot right now. And it's, you know, fairly easy to file these cases, especially when you just look at a product. You can see all of the patent numbers on that product. And in most cases, which with a simple Google search, you can go to google.com/patents, you can determine when each patent expired. Once you have an expired patent number on a product, you could file a lawsuit against that company for false marking.
Yeah, it seems to me to make a lot of sense, not being a patent lawyer, but just hearing you talk through this, to limit it to the competitors as being able to bring this sort of claim, because, you know, really they're the ones that are harmed by this kind of thing. When I pick up my Solo Cup and put a lid on it, if it's falsely marked for me as a consumer and user of the cup, that really makes no difference at all. So it seems like having the floodgates open to high damages in consumer suits over that kind of thing would be sort of counterproductive. Do you agree?
Yes, I think that the legislation, the pending legislation, is going in the right direction. What a lot of these cases, you know, 115 new cases now filed, a lot of what they're going to come down to is this intent to deceive the public element of false marking. So, you know, as I've said, the mere false marking, if I, you know, accidentally put an expired patent number or a patent number that doesn't cover my product on my product, that by itself doesn't rise to liability under the false marking statute. I had to have done it with an intent to deceive the public. And there's a little bit of case law, limited case law out there on what types of things could be considered an intent to deceive. What most of these cases, that where the rubber really hits the road, is going to be this intent to deceive element and why these companies, you know, did what they did. Were they acting reasonably in a commercial context? Did they receive advice from counsel that what they were doing was okay? All of these kind of issues are going to have to be explored in these cases.
All right. Well, I had the feeling this was going to be a really interesting and exciting topic, and I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek as I say that. So I'll go ahead and ask if Evan and Jonathan have anything that they want to close out on this false marking issue before we jump to something else. Evan?
The only thing I would add to it was, you know, who is it that should have standing, that whole analysis? It makes sense, I guess, to put it standing only in the hands of the competitors, even though there is obviously a strong public policy justification for protecting the interests of the consumers and what a consumer is likely to think when they're seeing a product that's falsely marked with a patent number indicating that it's a registered patent. So even though there is that public interest, that consumer-sided interest, it seems to makes sense to put this in line with how trademark law works. If you think of an action for false marking akin to an action for trademark infringement, you know, a general member of the consuming public doesn't have standing to sue somebody for trademark infringement or to, you know, just say, you know, to go against somebody for some kind of anti-competitive activity here. So that seems like it would be a good way to strike the balance if you put the standing just in the hands of the competitor with those understandings that it really is going to protect the public.
Right, exactly. Jonathan, any thoughts?
I was actually thinking about the trademark issue as well, actually. The whole idea of, you know, competitors being the only ones able to take action in these cases makes a lot of sense. It's what we do in trademark law. And in many ways, as far as the consumer protection side, this is very similar to trademark. And the other thing is something I mentioned this to another friend of mine here, and he jumped and said, you know, this reminds me a lot of the lawsuits that came from unsolicited faxes after that first became illegal. And you could obtain damages for that. And there was an automatic amount and so forth. And that was, admittedly, this hasn't been a big deal for some time, but we saw a huge floodgate of that right after the law was passed. And it sort of has subsided now as people have caught on. And I guess the end hope is that this will be a situation where companies will realize we probably shouldn't have expired patents on our products. They'll take action, and eventually this problem will sort of become, you know, well, not nearly as prevalent, and the issue will more or less right itself over time.
Yep, that sounds like a good way to look toward the future of this and a good implication of what the Federal Circuit is up to here. So I want to stay on patent law for a bit because there is an enormously important case pending in the United States Supreme Court right now called Bilski versus Kapos that has to do with basically the substance of patents themselves, what sort of a thing may be patented, and specifically business method and process-oriented kinds of patents, which have been controversial from the get-go, and we haven't really historically gotten too much guidance from the Supreme Court. And this is going to be a good way for the Supreme Court to jump into the world of modern technology and flesh out what sort of things are going to be patentable in today's day and age, and what sort of tests are going to apply, and whether the antiquated tests that we've been applying for years really have any significance now. So we could jump deep into Bilski and talk about the various tests and stuff, but I don't know that that's necessarily a productive use of our limited time here. There is a great article by John Squires and Dwayne Valls in our show notes called Waiting for Bilski that goes through it in some detail and gives a really nice overview of what's at stake and who applies what test and doesn't really make any guesses as to what the Supreme Court will do, which is smart because it's really hard to say what the Supreme Court's going to do in any given case. But what I thought it would be fun to do today, since, of course, we think of software patents in all kinds of contexts with the internet. But one thing that's coming fast down the pipe that we don't really think about software patents in connection with are our robot overlords, surrogate robots. There's a great article over at the unfortunately named Gizmag, or I won't say it the other way, about robots being more fact than fiction. It occurred to me as I was considering Bilski that, of course, you can't have a robot without the artificial intelligence software component of it. It's quite an integral part of the product. And so I think we just lost Justin, our one patent lawyer, on the call one more time. So we'll get his thoughts hopefully when we can get him back on the call here. He must be having some Skype issues. But Evan, I know you wanted to go into this surrogate issue. What do you think about all this?
So much to talk about here, and so many philosophical issues this raises and then the attendant legal issues that arise from that. Seems like I bring up robots with some amount of frequency in our conversations on here, just because I'm, of course, really interested in artificial intelligence and where things are going. You know, I watch, these days I watch, semantic web technologies and view that kind of as a precursor of some of the wonderful things with artificial intelligence that we're going to be experiencing as we approach the singularity in the next few decades and then our time beyond that. So this past year, I forget what time of the year it was, but I actually did see the movie Surrogates that's mentioned in this Gizmag post or article that's in our show notes here. And I really felt like that was one of the more underrated movies of 2009. That was a really great movie because it's one of those things that really gets you to thinking. I thought the movie itself was an interesting mixture of, Minority Report, The Matrix, and what was the Schwarzenegger movie from a few years ago? Was it...
not Terminator?
Total Recall. Yeah. And the whole notion of being somewhere else and existing somewhere else. It was just there are just so many interesting things that really get to the root of our humanity and the root of our consciousness when we start thinking about having these proxy agents, units of existence out there for us. And it one of the ways that I've been thinking about this a lot, and certainly some of the things that I thought about when reading this article is, what does it mean to be conscious when you're experiencing the world either through a robot, a proxy, a surrogate, an agent, however, whatever term you want to use. What does it mean to be conscious when you're doing that? And in relation to that, if one is to assume that a conscious being is then entitled to certain rights, that seems to be the entryway into a really interesting analysis in terms of ethics. And then you don't have to go too much further to talk about how the law will have to do some really interesting adaptation and perhaps make some fundamental changes in assumptions when we go about determining what rights of entities and agents that exist in the world, whether they are of biological intelligence or of non-biological intelligence, what rights and what things under the law should attach to those things. So just this really seems like an interesting context to talk about a lot of really fascinating issues and the patent issue that you brought up not being the least of those.
Right. I think Justin's back with us. Justin, do you see Bilski being a threat to me having my army of robot surrogates able to take care of my email needs and show prep and ensuring that anything that I may connect with on Facebook is not going to give me a communicable disease?
My answer would be it depends on, it would all depend on the patent and it would all depend on the claim. Apologies for dropping off just as you were getting into Bilski. One of the other things that the patent world is all a flutter about right now.
Right.
The Bilski case only concerns, process patents. Different inventions can be claimed in different ways. I could potentially claim something as a manufacturer or a machine, or I could claim a process related to that. I found that article on the surrogates very interesting. I haven't seen the movie. I think it didn't get the best reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and it probably is why I didn't end up seeing it. But actually, I may watch it now just to see what it's all about. Evan, have you seen it?
Yes, it's a great flick. You got to see it.
Okay, then I'll definitely put it on my Netflix list or something like that.
And I will do the same.
Yeah, me too. So I haven't seen it yet either.
I haven't seen it.
Does
Bilski touch software patents at all, or is it strictly something like, say, Amazon's one-click kind of procedure?
I think it does touch on software patents, but again, it's hard to say exactly what the court is going to do with the test. I mean, a lot of the applicability of Bilski is going to come down to how the Supreme Court actually crafts the test. If they craft it narrowly, you know, software patents may not be affected any more than they are right now. If they, you know, have a different test, it just depends. Things are so up in the air on it right now. And even in that article that is in the show notes, there's a number of different alternative tests that are raised.
And that are applicable in different courts even as we speak, correct? I mean, the courts are just all at sea about this.
Right. I mean, the Federal Circuit, which is, you know, besides the Supreme Court, is almost the Supreme Court of patent law, since not many patent cases get to the actual U.S. Supreme Court, has used this machine or transformation test. And that's what the whole, you know, Bilski when it was before the Federal Circuit was about, was the proper test. The Federal Circuit then said machine or transformation test. It either has to be tied to a machine or has to transform something into something else. So that is the test as it stands right now for all the district courts. You know, what that means and how that test is applied is obviously up for interpretation, but that is the test. But we'll see what the Supreme Court does. Hopefully we should have a decision here by, it could be coming any time now, but it should, I'm guessing it would definitely be here by the end of June.
Wow. MBE in the chat room just wrote, "We are all machines haphazardly wrought from meat by the blind machinations of a statistical process."
Hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, but I mean, that would suggest that there's no order that comes out. Well, I mean, that's weird to say that we're machines and that we're haphazardly wrought by blind machinations, because that would seem to deny that there's no kind of emergent property of order that could come out of that. That's one of those things you'd have to really digest. There's a lot in that sentence.
There sure is.
That seems to deny both intelligent design and evolution. It seems to deny both intelligent design and evolution. I wouldn't describe neither as haphazard.
Right.
Yeah, it's a pretty meaty sentence.
Yeah.
I'm surprised no one has said that we're all in the Matrix.
Well,
I did characterize...
Do you have good information that we're not?
You know, the movie Surrogates certainly does have some Matrix-y attributes to it. I think I compared it as being a mashup of The Matrix and Total Recall and Minority Report. If that's a compelling way of describing it, in this whole sense that consciousness can be experienced by an agent in one place and transmitted somewhere else, which is something that is inherently interesting to me. There's certainly a strong flavor of that in the film.
Yeah, I guess my overarching concern with the Bilski case and where it's headed is that, you know, there is a lot coming on the technological front that is completely bound up with process and software, either both of them or different species of the two, and that our legal system doesn't seem to have dealt well with how you're going to control innovation in that area yet. And so, right, you know, hoping that we get some kind of commonsensical framework announced from the Supreme Court, and just have fingers crossed to see if that happens. Any insights, Justin, on where you think Bilski will go?
Like I said, I think it's really hard to say at this point. I think if you ask, you know, 10 different patent attorneys, you might get 10 different answers. If you listen to the oral argument and the questions raised by the judges, and I think we may have discussed this the last time I was on TWIL a few months back, you know, there were a lot of different hypothetical situations that were being thrown at the attorneys for both sides. You know, for instance, I can't remember which justice it was, had mentioned, you know, patenting a process for keeping their students awake in antitrust law class. You know, so it's difficult to see, even given the oral argument, you know, where exactly the Supreme Court is falling. The problem is, it seems to me that the Supreme Court may know in the end what types of things it wants to see as being patentable and what types of things it wants to see as not being patentable, but crafting a test that goes through, that weaves through the fine line between patentability and non-patentability is just, it's a very difficult question. I would not want to be in the Supreme Court's shoes right now, having to come up with some sort of a test that courts could use with some degree of predictability.
No, I don't think any of us would, but I wish them good luck. Anyway,
as do I.
Last patent issue I wanted to touch on, and maybe we can segue with it to some DRM-ish thoughts, and that is the Apple versus HTC litigation. Just real quick, Justin, have you paid attention to that? And it's been much in the news lately. Just wondered if you had any insights about it and how it might impact innovation should Apple prevail.
I followed it. I haven't done any type of analysis as to the particular patents that are at issue in that case. I think it's an interesting approach given the you know, the publicity of this debate, this battle between Apple and Google, for Apple to not sue Google but to sue HTC instead is an interesting approach. You know, besides that, I've just been trying to follow along a little bit, you know, of the comments of others in the blogosphere. But like I said, I haven't gone through and actually done any type of analysis of all of the different patents that are involved in that case. We're a long way from knowing whether or not Apple is going to prevail, or whether there would be some sort of, you know, broad cross-licensing agreement between Apple and HTC, or whether there'll just be some other result. But I haven't had a chance to dig down too deep into the details, because once you start digging, you have to start digging a lot more just to be able to do a full analysis of the case.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk then about Apple and what it's doing to limit things, not on the patent front, but on the platform front with its iPhone and iPad stores and the sort of back and forth among developers and competitors about what gets to be in those stores. One story from David Pogan, the New York Times this week, talks about an app called Line 2, which allows iPhone users to use Wi-Fi to make phone calls. And it sounds like it's quite a nice little app. It gives you a second line to, if you wanted to create sort of a business presence with your iPhone, you could have your normal AT&T line and then this Line 2 line, hence the name, that does all kinds of Google Voice-ish kind functions and add-ons. And this is going along just fine in the iPhone store, despite the fact that Google Voice got booted from the store. So I wanted to toss it out to you guys and see if you have any thoughts on what's going on here, and throw into the mix, too, that Amazon has just announced that it's going to have a Kindle app for the iPad, as it does for the iPhone. Evan, what do you think about all this?
Well, with the Line 2 situation, that's intriguing. You know, I certainly don't have any insight into what's in the mind of Apple by permitting it. It's neat that it's there. I suppose there's at least a couple of things. There are at least a couple of things going on here. One is examining why it is that they would permit this. Is it called Talk to Me? You know, the company who is making Line 2. One portion of the analysis is why they would permit that to go on there and to be approved for inclusion into you know the app store. The other reason is why they would have precluded Google from participation earlier on, and I imagine that the portion of the analysis that would kind of go outside of the system and look at extraneous facts would be the analysis of looking as to why Apple. Chose to keep Google Voice out of there. And that has something to do more with the relations between these two titans of Apple and Google. And who knows what those internal workings are all about and what their thoughts are. As for the situation with Line 2, it would seem that Apple would want to be particularly careful with its relationship with AT&T. It would be neat to see what that agreement says. I'm sure it's a series of agreements that govern the relationship between Apple and AT&T. Because you would, if you're in AT&T shoes, you're going to wonder if there is any cause of action or any way that you can look at the agreements that you have with Apple to see if there's been some kind of breach, somehow usurping opportunities that AT&T has to be able to charge its customers for using their minutes on these things. So. I thought that was one, or there were at least two ways of looking at it from if we're going to try to bring in a legal standpoint on all of this. And also just wanted to mention, I had seen some tweets this morning and clicked through an article. It looked like that the Talk To Me service, you know, the provider of Line 2 had been the victim of a denial of service attack overnight. And it wasn't available as of early this morning. I don't know what the status of that is, but it certainly is getting the attention from people in several different walks of life, it looks like.
Right. And Xenophrenia was asking in the chat room whether this app actually turns an iTouch into a phone. And as Pogue points out in this article, yes, in fact, it does function that way. And I assume that means that when it is available on an iPad, it would do the same with that device, even though it's a rather clunky thing to have as a phone. But if you were choosing between devices to bring along with you and wanting to just bring one and had the ability and Wi-Fi enough to pick just your iPad, that would be one way of adding that functionality to it. And again, thwarting Apple's design for the device. Jonathan, do you think any of this is problematic? Oop, Jonathan, are you on mute?
Yes, I was. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
My first thought is if there are any Vegas bookies looking for a new site that they can start up, I recommend betting on what Apple will and will not approve in the App Store. We can start with Opera right now, actually. I'm taking bets on that one currently. But
you could even make an app that would allow you to place bets. That'd be pretty neat.
Oh, yeah, there you go. There's an app for that. Excellent idea.
Kind of meta.
I see a new business forming here. This is great.
I like that one.
I've always found, though, Apple's two-handed approach to what it approves and what it doesn't approve. Because remember, it recently delisted a lot of apps that were listed in the adult-themed apps, so to speak, not necessarily pornographic, but adult-like apps. And that's right. The chat room just reminded us they don't allow gambling apps. So I'm sorry. Sorry, Evan. Our business just got shut down. but it's an interesting problem from a platform standpoint. And I was wondering earlier, does the iPad have a microphone in it? I'm trying to remember. I just simply don't know that one.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But anyways,
I don't remember that one either.
So I don't know if you could turn an iPad into a phone. But another interesting idea. Sorry, someone just walked in. Apologies.
That's okay.
No, but another interesting point to all this is whether or not one could, whether or not there's anything actionable, like you said, from between AT&T and Apple in this one. And that's the real conflict here, because supposedly that was the reason why Google Voice, remember, got prevented from being in the App Store. It was supposed to be this agreement from between Apple and AT&T that prevented it, not anything to do with the iPhone itself or with the actual language, they or the actual approval process, but it was some kind of agreement with AT&T. Now, there's been some dispute whether or not that's the case, but that was the initial excuse that Apple gave for preventing Google Voice from coming in. I wonder if either the agreements have changed or if that was just blowing smoke, or if this is perhaps, Line 2 is perhaps proof of that.
Yeah, I'm being told that the iPad does in fact have an onboard mic, and that it can also take a headset with an inline mic. So
okay, there you go.
Either way, so, you want to go about it.
Oh, there you go. I just didn't remember. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, just like the iTouch. So it can be phonified by this.
Yeah, but
app.
can you just picture somebody, you know, using the actual microphone on the iPad? They have this big thing that they're, you know, hello. And I know I've seen John C. Dvorak on his podcast mentioning that a number of times. I just can't get that thought out of my head when I think about an app like this.
Hey, has anyone seen the Upright Citizens Brigade by any chance? And the bit they used to do where they would have that guy with the super large cell phone going into the public and shouting into it in very inappropriate situations, like at a concert. And it was always the phone rings. What? Hello? That's what I think of when you think of an iPad being used as a phone.
Yeah, right. But it is, if you used a headset and an inline mic, it is one camera away from my being able to do this show on it. So I'm kind of excited for its various uses
Denise, you combine that with the surrogates, you're out of a job.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
See, we're just one step away from eliminating ourselves. I mean, it's just saying.
Oh, well, the Supreme Court will no doubt protect us from all that. Joel Schoen over on our Facebook page, which before the show, I always try and post a few questions for folks to chime in on that we hopefully can incorporate their thoughts. That's at denise.howell.net/FB if you want to check in before the next show. Joel, in commenting on the Kindle app for the iPad, says he thinks it's why Amazon publicized it earlier this week. They wanted to force any possible Apple rejection right into the public view. Because, of course, a Kindle app on the iPad is going to compete head-to-head with the iBook store. And, you know, now that Kindle is out there and lots of us already have a whole library of books that we've purchased in that platform, it sure will be nice to be able to read them on the iPad. And supposedly the graphics are quite nice and you can turn pages with it with the touch of your finger, that kind of like the iBook application is going to do. So pretty interesting to see that play out. Someone in the chat room pointed us to a great article posted yesterday by David Gewitz over at ZDNet on the government blog there, 5 Lessons Apple Can Learn from Amazon, which is a great commentary about how it's not about the device. It's about letting people, even if you have a DRM'd product, like an ebook has to be mandated by the publishers, if you can move it around seamlessly among devices, you're going to have very happy customers who are going to come back and buy more and more and more.
Yeah.
Our sponsor, Audible, is a great example of that. When they first started out, they had DRM'd products that they had to have because that's what their publishers who occupy their store require. They had their own device way back in the beginning because there just weren't that many MP3 players out there. You know, maybe there was one when they launched, if that. And I think actually when they launched, there were none. So they had to have their own device. But as devices rapidly became available, and of course the iPod came to dominate, they were in there making sure that their products worked on all those devices. Amazon seems to be following suit in that regard, which is a super smart strategy as far as, you know, I'm concerned. And Apple just doesn't seem to do that except for perhaps with the MP3s that it makes available in its music store. But again, the absence of DRM on those has been a slow process. Evan, any thoughts about these dynamics?
I hadn't seen that article about, I was just kind of scanning out what you were talking about that there, what Apple can learn from Amazon. And I just like this sentence in here somewhere where I'm scrolling back down to find it now, but just talking about how important it is. It's about half the way down. Realizing that readers are collectors, and that just underscores the importance of cross-platform availability of these things. I could not imagine, you know, what my life would be like or what my life would have been like had I not, you know, had a bookshelf wherever I have lived and the ability to go and pull works off of the shelf at random times and just be able to browse them and see where those will take me. So that just really seems to be one of the fundamental driving forces behind all of this and a norm or a mode that I hope is that I hope informs the decision makers when it comes to how things move forward with all of this crazy file format stuff.
Yeah, Jonathan, you write plagiarism today. Do you think that there is any movement away from the tight DRM strategy so that these things play more nicely with each other? Or can we look forward to just hoping that the manufacturers include the DRM but make it a seamless experience for people?
You know, I think it's going to be a little bit of both. I mean, there have been some examples of stepping away from ebook DRM. O'Reilly Books recently got away from ebook DRM. I think they did that a couple of years ago, and we're seeing a huge jump in their sales since they did it. So obviously, it's helping make customers happy and helping them feel assured that they'll be able to take that product and do with it what they want. But at the same time, what you pointed out about, you know, customers not hating DRM as long as it works well, as long as it allows them to do what they want, it definitely seems to be the case. You know, in the video game world, for example, look at what Steam does. Steam is essentially DRM, but since it functions as a convenient way to buy and to play games, people have been tolerating it pretty well. So I think we're going to see a little bit of both. I think it's going to be a situation where we're going to see some limited DRM, but there's going to be very, very high portability. And basically, it's going to be a game of who can assure the customers the most that their products are safe and that they own them. Because it's clear, especially when you're dealing with books, customers want to own their product. They want to collect them. They want to hold on to it. And it's the same with music and movies, too. And they don't like this idea of being forced to repurchase their entire library every X number of years because the technology changes. So the more of those assurances that can be offered, the more customers they're going to get and the better they're going to do overall. I think that's the way it's going to go. It's going to be a combination of marketing and technology there.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears for a minute and talk about another industry where DRM is super important, the film and movie industry. Did anyone get a chance to take a look at this Washington Post piece? Once again, there's just a lot of confusion and disagreement over what the actual numbers mean. Movie industry. The headline here is the MPAA says the movie business is great unless it's lousy. And apparently they have been releasing one set of numbers that are talking about in theater sales and then another set of numbers that are talking about damage to those sales by so-called piracy. Is this just a question of the MPAA not knowing that it's talking out of the both sides of its mouth, or is there some way of reconciling all of this? Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, what I've understood in reading various articles is that the movie theater-wise, theater attendance has been extremely high. In fact, I think they had their best year last year ever, pretty much. So as far as movie theater attendance and ticket sales, it's been great. They've had a banner year there. It's the DVD sales, it's the physical product sales that have really been hurt. And some of that is due to piracy, but some of it is due to, you know, Netflix, Redbox, all these, you know, cheap and effective means of renting DVDs that are completely legal. So they're kind of being squeezed from multiple sides in the DVD sales department. And I think that's definitely hurting their business in a major way. I think, but that's where you're getting these disparate numbers typically, is they're referring to, you know, great success in one area, but a great failing and a great collapse in another. So it's a very interesting time for the movie industry.
It's post hoc, ergo propter hoc all over again.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it definitely seems to be more of a qualitative characterization that the movie industry is making, at least on their tale of woe. You know, we look at what they're saying here. There are actual numbers when they're talking about how robust the industry is and how well it's doing. But then it's just talking about how we face these relentless challenges of piracy and all of that stuff. And it seems to be that there could be a number of ways of reconciling these things. I guess one is, I'm at least implying it by saying what I have said, that it's just merely a qualitative look. There are always ways to put spins on things, always ways to say things euphemistically, if you will. And the other couple ways of looking at it could be the fact that maybe piracy is good for the movie industry. I know that a lot of people want to say that, you know, that the viral interest in things is going to actually stimulate people to purchase more media and to consume more media for a price. You know, who knows what that's all about, whether that's valid or not, but maybe that's one thing that's going on here. The other thing would be an argument that you see sometimes that the content industry makes. I think that it was actually in the Grokster opinion somewhere the content industry will say, yes, we're making a lot of money, but we would be making even more if it weren't for piracy. So there are that's one way of looking at it, is that it yes, it's good, but it could be even gooder if there if there wasn't this stuff going on.
Gooder. Right.
Justin, how about you? Do you still have a vast DVD collection, or are you working toward other ways of consuming your media? And do you think that that's what's eating into DVD sales?
I think it could be what's eating into DVD sales. I think, as the other speakers have pointed out, that there is definitely a difference between the movie theater experience and watching a movie on DVD, especially when you have things like Netflix or Boxy or these other technologies that are coming out that don't require you to purchase a DVD to watch it once and then let it sit on your shelf for quite some time. My purchase of DVDs and now Blu-rays has gone down a little bit. Now that I actually have a Blu-ray player, I have purchased a number of Blu-rays just to see how good they can look on a nice screen. But, you know, at least in watching movies in the first instance, there's, you know, a definite difference between watching a movie like Avatar on an IMAX 3D screen versus, you know, I of course haven't downloaded Avatar, and I wouldn't want to, because I wouldn't want to watch it on a, you know, a laptop screen or something like that with poor quality. There are certain, especially action movies, I just like to go to the theater to experience the movie and have that, you know, booming sound and have that ridiculously huge screen. But when it comes to the DVD side of the equation, you know, the paradigm is shifting as to how people consume this content, and it's going to continue to shift over time, and we'll just have to see how folks like the MPAA deal with this shift.
Well, one way that they've been dealing with this shift is pushing for three strikes laws wherever they can, with lots of change in that regard happening over in Europe, and rumors of that included in the ACTA drafts that are leaking. Evan, have you modified your opinion on this at all, or do you still think that three strikes might actually be a practical way to make sure that things can be gooder for the entertainment industry?
Who knows? You know, maybe I'm just in an indecisive mood today, or maybe I'm being incredibly, analytical and realizing the subjective nature of everything once you get down to the minute level of examination. First of all, I don't know what ACTA says, and I don't think I'm alone in that regard. I think I'm in the boat with pretty much the rest of the world, except a handful of select few who even know what ACTA says. But that doesn't stop us from being able to evaluate the whole notion of a graduated response, the three strikes and you're out rule, which actually would be more like four strikes.
But we know that France already has it.
Okay, good.
And we know that England is considering it.
Yes. So we can, and you know, in a certain sense, we've had it here all along with the DMCA, with the obligation of service providers to terminate the accounts of repeat infringers. mm-hmm. obviously not taking them off the internet completely, but disabling them from the particular service, like saying you can't use YouTube anymore or something like that. So we've had plenty of time to evaluate it as a principle and to think about it. And I guess that in general, I am not so concerned about the due process issues so long as there are no due process issues to be concerned about, I guess. That was pretty an artful way of saying it. But from what I gather about all of these things, the things that I've seen about ACTA and most of the commentary describing what the graduated response procedures are like, there is always a means of recourse. And for the person affected, for the one who is being cut off from the internet. And even in the absence of something procedural within the mechanism, I cannot imagine a situation where one would not have, and I think this is at least the third time I've mentioned this in conversations like this, I cannot imagine a situation where one would not have the opportunity to go and ask a court for a declaratory judgment saying that, you know, I have not committed infringement, and so that my access to being cut off from the access to the internet is a violation of both my due process rights and my First Amendment rights. Perhaps, you know, there could be some novel theories like that. And it's at this point where I can start feeling like I can remember the days when Colette was on the show, because this was right when she would jump in and say things along these lines. So I guess to crystallize or to encapsulate what my thoughts are on this, maybe I wasn't so far off by saying I don't have any concerns about due process or concerns along those veins if there are mechanisms built in or provided by law by default that will ensure that the due process concerns can be met. I just can't really think of an alternate way to as effectively deal with the problem of infringement. I'm a moderate when it comes to all of this stuff. I represent content producers and copyright owners routinely. I also mm-hmm. routinely represent people who are being accused of infringement, and I see both sides of it. I think that there has to be a careful factual evaluation in every situation, and that it's dangerous for us to be very polarized in our thinking to the exclusion of the interests on the other side of the equation from oneself.
Right. I don't have this in the show notes yet, but someone mentioned in the chat room earlier, it went up today at Ars Technica from Nate Anderson, a study released in France post their three strikes law. Researchers in Rennes, France's Brittany region, have released a paper based on 2,000 phone surveys with Brittany residents, indicating basically that piracy is up after the three strikes law had passed. And that former P2P users simply migrated to illegal streaming sites and HTTP-based download services. So far, the whacking of the mole via the tougher legislation there has not had the desired effect. But it is early days, and who knows, as the penalties begin to play themselves out.
Those penalties are interesting. I was at I've talked about this a couple times before. I was at a conference at Widener Law School in Pennsylvania last month, mm-hmm. and one of my co-panelists was Professor Peter Yu from Drake University, and just a really, really entertaining presentation. He focused on the three strikes rule, the graduated response, I loved his PowerPoint because it had a lot of pictures and very little text. So, you know, it was prima facie good in that respect. But one of the things that he talked about was and he was using some dramatic effect to kind of point out some of the sillier aspects of the graduated response and how effective the remedy could be. He says, well, why don't we just cut off people's hands? And, he put up some quotes from some old statutes from back in the Middle Ages. Of where, you know, people could have their hands chopped off for very minor, what we would view as relatively minor infractions these days. And he says, you know, that would really be a very effective way of making sure that people wouldn't infringe copyright anymore, because without hands, you know, how can you click the mouse or, you know, surf the web to find infringing, or surf the internet to find infringing material. So the point being, you can easily look at these remedies and see them as absurd if you want to characterize them in a certain way.
Yes, well, hand chopping, I think, is sort of beyond discussion.
The content industry has some very important interests here. You know, piracy is awful. You know, it's killing us. It's supporting the terrorists. I don't know.
Jonathan, do you think that these kinds of measures are akin to the sort of punishments that we in civilized societies feel are best left to our embarrassing history?
You know, it's interesting. As internet becomes more and more important, someone in the chat said internet's becoming as important as water, and indeed in some cases I could see how that would be. But at the same time, I might also argue that my automobile is as important for water. I don't know how I would survive without my automobile. How would I drive to get groceries? But yet, if I use my automobile in an irresponsible manner, even if no one gets injured, if I just continuously use it in an irresponsible manner, that right can be taken away from me. I can have my license revoked. I can have, you know, my automobile impounded. I can have all kinds of punishments that would prevent me from being able to drive. So, I mean, I don't know if I would equate it to the chopping off of hands, but there are definitely other things that might be analogous too. As far as such a system, personally, I'm kind of skeptical on whether or not it will actually work. I'm interested in seeing it tried. I think, you know, you quoted that Ars Technica article that found, you know, you found that it had increased in France since the passing of the three strikes. I think we're very early in the game. I think we're going to need at least a few years worth of data before it becomes reliable. We're going to need to see the first, you know, punishments be handed out. But I think, you know, right now, a lot of what's going on the internet is experimentation. And we're going to see experiments on all sides, experiments of opening up and tolerating piracy, experiments on cracking down. And, you know, it's survival of the fittest. Whatever's the best solution will come out on top. I don't have the instant answers to what that's going to be.
Justin, is there any sort of parallel to this kind of a penalty in patent law? Or is this something unique that the content industry has come up with?
I don't think there's really a parallel. I mean, the closest thing that, you know, would come to in the patent context is a preliminary or permanent injunction that would, you know, force an accused infringer to stop making the product at issue because it actually, you know, infringes the patent. But, you know, just adding on to what's been said before, I think this is just another case of the law is just trying to catch up with technology. You know, it's like Wile E. Coyote chasing the Roadrunner. Will Wile E. Coyote ever catch the Roadrunner? You know, is the big question. In the cartoons, obviously not. But, you know, we'll see what happens. It is interesting. It's an interesting penalty and an interesting idea of a penalty to essentially shut off somebody's internet access. But I agree with, I think I agree with Evan that as long as there's some sort of safeguards that would prevent someone from, you know, just intentionally getting me in trouble for this, such that my internet would be turned off, if I actually do have some sort of recourse along the way that I can pursue, you know, it makes the idea a little bit more palatable. I just question whether there are other more effective ways of trying to curb piracy than just shutting off somebody's internet access.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And I worry about what kind of safeguard could be built in that continues to end run the judicial system, which is where all of this resides at present. And
one thing no one mentioned, but I want to touch on real, real quickly, is open Wi-Fi access. Like bars and restaurants and so forth, how would that be affected by three strikes? And that's something that's very unclear, even in the laws that have been passed.
Well, we should just have everybody register. I think that if you go to a cafe and you want to use their Wi-Fi hotspot, you have to make a photocopy of your driver's license and give them your social security number before you log on. I'm joking. Oh, you don't like that idea?
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, right. Yeah.
You know, somebody's just going to take that last few seconds of audio or video and use that as a soundbite and really think that I'm a, you know, really have been taking crazy pills.
Yep, absolutely. There's something definitely useful there. Well, I don't want to sign off without pointing folks toward our resource of the week. I was watching a great show on the Smithsonian HD channel, which we're lucky enough to get on our cable system. And it was, here, let me find it in the notes here. The it's called System Crash Wired Planet. And it was a great show. If you've got that network and you haven't seen it, DVR it and check it out. It's a great commentary on sort of the internet backbone and how things work. If you ever, as I do, wonder in perplexed fascination about how we can all sit here on Skype and do a show like this. It gets under the hood a bit and talks about the vulnerability and the invulnerability of the internet at its core. And it also discusses something, you know, since we're here watching the whole Google China thing unfold on a daily basis, there is a tool called Siphon that is mentioned in that show, P-S-I-P-H-O-N. That's going to be our resource of the week. And what Siphon does, it is an application that was developed by the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto in Canada. And it is a proxy system that you can go ahead and put on your computer. And when you do this, you're doing a very nice thing for people using Siphon in countries like China. What it does is it enables them to surf basically as you. So if you're in Canada, someone using Siphon from a restricted country would have access to everything that you do, and it would be anonymous for them. So it's kind of like, do you remember the applications that used to run in the background and would do large mathematical equations like SETI at home, things like that?
Yeah.
With your unused computer cycles, it's a bit like that. It's something you can just put on your computer, not think about again. It's you know, might be a little bit scary, but I think that the folks who developed it were careful and did a good job not to, you know, turn your computer into a zombie via this. It's really a way of doing a public service and helping people out in countries where the internet is not as freely available as it is in some of our own. So check out Siphon and do a good deed for some folks out there. Any last thoughts as we close out, Justin?
Not really. I mean, the patent context, the things that are coming down the pike are definitely the Bilski decision. Pending patent reform, which there's been a lot of talk in the blogosphere on. And, you know, like we discussed a little bit today, I hope I didn't put too many people to sleep, the false marking cases, which are just affecting more and more companies as time goes on. It'll be interesting to see what both the Federal Circuit, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the legislature, if they act on patent reform, what everybody decides to do with some of the problems that we're encountering right now.
Wonderful. And we'll stay tuned to Gray on Claims for more developments on all those fronts. Thanks so much for joining us today, Justin.
Thank you very much. Yes, come and visit Gray on Claims or follow me on Twitter at Gray on Claims. It's Gray with an A. Great to be on the show again.
Great. Thank you so much. And Jonathan, over at Plagiarism Today, what's the hot next thing on your radar?
Well, right now, we're still waiting on the counter filings motions of summary judgment in the Google Viacom case. I think that's going to be the next big thing. I'm really excited to see how both sides respond to that. And also a quick PSA. When using Facebook, please use protection. Dozens of people have been given syphilis over the service and over the past year. I saw it on The Guardian. It must be true. So please, be safe when on Facebook.
Always be safe on Facebook.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. Safe booking.
Safe booking. Yes, absolutely. We should come up with a logo.
Yes. Jonathan is over at plagiarismtoday.com. He is also at plagiarismtoday on Twitter. Definitely full of interesting and current things in the copyright arena. And Evan Brown, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Well, thanks for having me back. Good to be back. I had a week or two off there, so always good. So, sometimes I think of my life as just everything that I do between Friday afternoons when I'm on This Week in Law. So it's always a great time.
Absolutely. You just described my life in a nutshell. Are you attending the Legal Tech Conference over there in Chicago at all?
It's been going on. I'm going to go kind of walk through the exhibit hall here in a little bit. And it's the ABA's tech show. And there's an event going on later this afternoon that I might try to go to with Kevin O'Keefe and some others. It just depends on how things go here in the office this afternoon. But it's a sunny day in Chicago, even though it's a little chilly. So I might try to head over there to the Hilton here in a little bit and see some people who I know are in town.
Yes, I saw he was mixing beer and lawyers, about as dangerous a combination as Facebook and remote British towns.
Right, right.
But so be safe.
Yeah, I'm hoping to run into Ernie at some point. So I know he's in town.
Good. We'll give him our best. And in the meantime, we will follow along with you at internetcases.com and internetcases on Twitter.
That's right. Thank you.
Thank you. And folks, I am Dee Howell on Twitter. I post over at Bag and Baggage from time to time. Generally, I'm posting about the show or my kid or whatever else is on my mind. So you can find me there. And do shoot me an email if you'd like, denise@twit.tv, with any questions, comments about the show. Follow along with us on Facebook, too, and check out our pre-show questions and give us your thoughts in advance. And with that, we'll go ahead and sign out. This Week in Law, episode 53. We'll see you next week, Friday, 11 p.m. live at live.twit.tv. Thanks very much.
Right on. See you later.